from the Radio Ranch in beautiful Sugar Land, Texas, where life truly is sweeter. It's the Bombastic Blogcast for Friday, February 23rd, 2024. I'm the G-Man, Dan Gallo.
Hey, G-Man.
There yourself. Defender of the peace, keeper of the justice, purveyor of truth, and one heck of a nice guy. And it is Hawaiian Shirt Friday. Come on, everybody, sing along. Sing it loud, sing it proud. Truly the sweetest sound this side of heaven. Let's get things started officially with
the Daily Datagram.
You got it. Words of wisdom, words of inspiration, brain droppings, or noggin nuggets. You get to make the call. It says, be bold in what you stand for and careful for what you fall for. Because either way, you're likely to be punished for both.
Oh, no.
Let's move along now to the so-called educational part of the blogcast. Let's do it.
Twisted history.
That's what I'm talking
about. Gather around, kids, because a lot of things happen on this day throughout history.
Oh, I know.
Some cool, some not so cool.
To be sure.
Just the same. You need to know your twisted history.
Yes, you do.
You might be quizzed.
I wouldn't sweat that. Well, kids, it was on this day in 1927, President Calvin Coolidge signed a bill by Congress establishing the Federal Radio Commission, later replaced by the Federal Communications Commission, which was to regulate the use of radio frequencies in the United States, because prior to that, radio signals were broadcasting all over each other. You know, kind of like social media today, right? And it was on this day in 1954, the first mass inoculation of children against polio with the Salk vaccine began in Pittsburgh. Kids all lined up like dutiful little soldiers and took their shot. A couple of years later, though, the vaccine was replaced with an oral version, and kids loved it.
Ooh, I like that.
Here's something for you to consider as you go about your ordinary day today. If you're struggling financially, let's just say for sake of argument, you only had $100 to feed your family for the month, but then turned around and pulled $300 out of savings to give to some strangers. Think that would sit pretty well with your family, huh? First of all, they'd wonder why you did that. They'd question their importance, why these people are so important, why you want to help them. And you take care of your household first, right? I mean, those are the ones entrusted to you to care for, your family. But that's exactly what Congress has done. They've given three times as much to strangers across the pond in Ukraine as they've spent on our own border. Now, this ought to have you grinding your teeth by now. So where do you and I stand in the eyes of those in Congress? It's not too hard to guess. According to WorldNet Daily, from February 2022 to December 2023, Congress appropriated about three times as much money for its response to the conflict in Ukraine as the federal government spent on customs and border protection. Congress approved approximately $113.4 billion in spending related to the Ukraine conflict during this period, while the government spent only $37.82 billion. On customs and border protection. They should change the name of that, customs and border prevention. You know, the U.S. Congress appropriated approximately $113.4 billion in supplemental appropriations for the U.S. response to Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine between February of 22 and December of 23, making the United States the largest single donor of assistance to the Ukraine response. And that's according to a report published February 15th by the Inspectors General for the Department of Defense, the Department of State, and the U.S. Agency for International Development. The report went on to say that this funding supports security assistance for NATO and other partner nations, support for an enhanced U.S. military presence and activity in Europe, and the replenishment of U.S. military stocks transferred to the Ukrainian armed forces. The funding also supports security, economic, and humanitarian assistance to Ukraine and other countries affected by the war, support for the operations of U.S. government agencies involved in the Ukraine response. So what impact did this massive U.S. investment have on the course of the conflict? Well, the IG report says that while the Ukrainian armed forces succeeded in recovering more than half of the territory that Russian forces had seized at the start of the conflict, the front line in the war in Ukraine hasn't moved significantly since the gains made in the fall of 2022 Ukrainian counteroffensive. Now, during the last quarter of 2023, Russian forces continued to occupy most of Luhansk, Donetsk, Kherson, and Crimea oblasts. And this lack of substantial progress on both sides belies the heavy fighting and high casualty rates during 2023. So, from February through September of 22, the government spent $12.063 billion on customs and border protection. And that's according to the monthly Treasury statement. In all of fiscal 23, which ended last September, it spent $20.32 billion. And in October through December, it spent $5.727 billion. So that means from February 22, when Russia started its all-out war against Ukraine, until December of 23, just the last December, a couple of months ago, the U.S. government spent a total of $37.822 billion on customs and border protection. And that equals just 33.35% of the $113.4 billion that, according to the Inspectors General, Congress approved in supplemental appropriations for the U.S. response to Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine during that same period. Meanwhile, at the border, tactical gear-wearing immigrants are looking for a nice life. Yeah, these people are coming across the border now wearing tactical gear. It's nerve-wracking. And just to show you the proportions this is taking, Venezuelan criminal syndicates are threatening Americans. There was an interesting development that highlights the escalating crisis on the border. City of Miami has become the latest battleground in a war against foreign criminal elements. The notorious Venezuelan gang, Tren de Aragua, marked its entry into the United States, a violent entry, with a heinous act of murder that has shaken the local community to its core. The incident involved a 23-year-old male believed to be a member of this gang who was apprehended following a brutal homicide that bore the hallmarks of a gang-initiated crime. And they're saying that this event is not an isolated occurrence, but a symptom of a larger, more disturbing trend of unchecked migration that allows dangerous criminals to infiltrate American society. There are already thousands of Chinese nationals, all male, of soldier age, already in this country. You have to wonder, are they awaiting further orders from the CCP? A couple of weeks ago, I warned you, in the next few years, well, I said at that time, what, roughly 15 to 20 years, this country's really going to feel this. We're really going to feel the result of these millions, upwards of 8 to 10 million people who have come into the country illegally. We're going to feel that effect. But I don't think we're going to have to wait 15 to 20 years. I think we're going to start feeling it very soon. And I don't know. I'm not trying to make you quake in your boots, but it's not going to be a good thing. Looks like we may have dodged a bullet of a sort, at least for now. Tom Ozimek, writing in the Epoch Times, says a state appeals court Wednesday declared as unconstitutional a New York City law, and remember, it's just a city law, permitting non-citizen voting in local elections, which, of course, is a victory for election integrity advocates and people like you and me, opponents of the legislation, who mounted a legal challenge. I don't know if you're aware of that, but there was a rather brisk local legal challenge to this up there in New York. And the reading, the ruling, which was issued February 21st by the Appellate Division for the Second Judicial Department of the Supreme Court of the state of New York, said, "We determine that this local law was enacted in violation of the New York State Constitution and municipal home rule law, and thus must be declared null and void." Now, the law was dubbed Our City, Our Vote, and it was first passed in December of 2021 by the Democrat-controlled New York City Council, opening the door to allowing some 800,000 documented non-citizens. Now, I don't know if the fact that they're documented is of any comfort, but they were non-citizens. And the stipulation was they had to have federal work authorizations to vote in all New York City municipal elections, including for mayor. I find some comfort in that, but not a lot. Now, progressive Democrats who championed the law argued that it would make U.S. politics more inclusive by allowing immigrants without citizenship to vote. That term, immigrants without citizenship. You know, some of those immigrants have been here for a long, long time, and they're still waiting on their chance to take their oath of citizenship. But some don't want to become citizens. So, you know, what of that, huh? Now, former New York Council member Yudanis Rodriguez, a Democrat who co-sponsored the bill, told the publication The Nation back in the summer of 21 that at its most basic level, the consequence of the measure is that we're not going to be expanding voting rights. I'm sorry, we are going to be expanding voting rights. Where did I see the word not in that? Wow. Somebody look at me. Am I cross-eyed this morning? Okay. State Republican chairman and now U.S. Representative Nick Langworthy told a press conference in December of 21, just days before the bill passed, he says, "We pledge action, any means necessary to stop this dangerous legislation undermining our elections." He said, "We'll pursue every legal action to see that this dangerous law is struck down. Besides being bad policy, it's unconstitutional, it's dangerous and un-American." Amen on that. And then soon after the bill became law in January of 22, it was challenged in court by Mr. Langworthy and a handful of other plaintiffs. Months later, the law was struck down. And Judge Ralph Porzio of the New York State Supreme Court for Staten Island ruled that the Our City, Our Vote legislation violated the state constitution, which states that every citizen is entitled to vote. Citizen. But New York City Mayor Eric Adams' administration defended the law and appealed the lower court ruling. Now, Wednesday's appeals court decision dealt a blow to those efforts. And at this point, it's still unclear whether Mr. Adams' office intends to file an appeal. But Representative Nicole Malliotakis, who's a Republican, who is also one of the plaintiffs in the case, posted on X, "Great news, we won in the appellate court. And New York City mayor's attempt to implement the new law to register non-citizens to vote in New York City has been struck down. This is a big victory in preserving both the integrity of our elections and the voice of American citizens." Well, you know, when I think of American citizens, I'm thinking about, you know, Joe Lunchbox, the hard hat safety vest wearing worker along the roadways, our veterans. So that's what I think about when I think of U.S. citizens. And now you get somebody who just comes into the country, legally or illegally, and you give them the right to vote? I don't think so. But again, that law had the stipulation you had to be approved by the federal government to be here in order to vote as a non-citizen. Still, it's not a good law. So the Public Interest Legal Foundation, known as the PILF, filed a similar federal lawsuit alleging that the non-citizen voting law violated the 15th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution and the Voting Rights Act because, as the group claims, it was passed with clear racial intent. So PILF President J. Christian Adams said in a statement reacting to Wednesday's ruling, "This ruling marks an important step to stop foreign interference in New York City's elections." Members of the New York City Council made explicit statements that race was the motivation behind this voting law. In America, we do not allow race-based voting restrictions. So Tom Osmek in Epoch Times wrote, "While there are laws that prohibit non-citizens from voting in federal elections, there are no such specific prohibitions in state constitutions. However, there are 8 states that have laws stipulating that non-citizens may not vote in state and local elections. Those states are Alabama, Arizona, Colorado, Florida, Louisiana, North Dakota, Ohio, and now New York." Texas isn't in there? Wow. A new bill recently introduced in the Kentucky House of Representatives seeks to make it the 9th state to prohibit non-citizens from voting. I don't know, but when I see what's going on in our country these days, the way Joe Biden and company are selling us down the river to China, and anybody else is willing to line his pockets, man, I have never been in such fear for my country. John Doherty, writing in Conservative Brief, says that a Northwestern University law school professor has sounded off following New York Judge Arthur Engoron, which rhymes with moron, his massive $355 million fraud finding against former President Trump, calling it the most unjust act in U.S. politics since an 1804 duel between Revolutionary War figures. This is interesting stuff. Stephen Calabresi wrote for Reason's Volokh Conspiracy. Quote, "The civil fraud judgment against Donald Trump is a travesty and an unjust political act, rivaled only in American politics by the killing of former Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton by Vice President Aaron Burr." Now, you might remember that story from when you were in school. Well, that is, if you are of a certain age. I doubt they tell this story anymore. Who knows? Anyhow, in July of 1804, Burr fatally shot Hamilton in a duel in New Jersey. And this was following a prolonged and very acrimonious political rivalry between the two. Burr was charged with murder for his actions, but the case never made it to trial. Now, in his op-ed, this guy Calabresi, the Northwestern Law School prof and Federalist Society co-chairman, important to note that, called on the U.S. Supreme Court to intervene over the grossly excessive fine and Kafkaesque civil trial. He wrote that, at most, Trump is guilty of tax fraud. He also wrote, "The New York state laws used to go after Trump have never been used in this way historically, and while Trump may owe some back taxes, state taxes, if Judge Engoron is right, not a single bank claimed that it had been defrauded by Trump in the loans that it made to him. This is truly a victimless crime." Well, we've heard that all week long. All this week, all the talking heads on TV have said, who got hurt? What was the crime? Who complained? Now, Trump's spokeswoman and attorney, Alina Haba, has vowed legal vengeance against New York attorney, or New York Attorney General, Letitia James. Here's what Alina had to say the other night when she was on Sean Hannity's program.
"I think the biggest message I can give the American people tonight is that he's not going to get away with it. Letitia James is not going to get away with it. The Biden administration is not going to get away with it. There is a point, and I want to say something that different than I normally do. We have the order now. I'm free to speak. And let me just say, as somebody who sat there in the trial, Sean, and I'm so happy you invited me on to say this, they will not get away with it. We will come at them. We will come hard. And we will literally fight until the truth comes out. There was nothing wrong. President Trump has done nothing wrong. All he has done is won a campaign And that is scaring them because they know when he goes back in November 2024, he is going to clean house. And that is truly the problem. It's not about Mar-a-Lago's worth. It's not worth $18 million. It's worth probably $1.5 billion at the least. It is not worth Trump Tower, 40 Wall Street. That's not what this is about, Sean. You know it and I know it. This is the new form of election interference. This is a campaign that cannot succeed with Biden and Kamala. So what they have to do is weaponize DAs and AGs, have Soros back them, fund them, Reid Hoffman back them, fund them, and come after Trump, everything Trump, including his children, his company, employees that are working for him, doing their job. That is the desperation of our country at this moment, which is about to go into world war. This is crazy. And it's Trump derangement syndrome. That's literally the best thing I could explain to you. And just know this, and for all those people that understand what is going on, we will win. We will fight because the facts are on our side. There are politicized judges. There are politicized DAs and AGs. But I do not have a doubt that in the end we will succeed.
I don't know about you, but to me, she sounds like she means it. And she's done some very, very good work for Mr. Trump. Now, Engoron gave James nearly all of the $370 million she was seeking against Trump and his two sons, Donald Trump Jr. and Eric Trump, after he decided last fall that they'd committed fraud in order to secure more favorable loan rates from banks by overinflating the value of their assets. Now, Shark Tank star and investor and very wealthy guy, nice fella too, Kevin O'Leary, said this week that former President Trump's fraud ruling is making him rethink investing in the mega loser state of New York. We played some sound bites from Kevin the other day here on the podcast. Excuse me. He says, "I'm not different than any other investor. I'm shocked at this. I can't even understand or fathom the decision at all. There's no rationale for it." And in an interview with Fox and Friends Weekend, O'Leary even said it's not necessarily about Trump. And this is where that discussion got really interesting, because he said, forget about the Trump factor. It's not about that. What does this say to everybody that wants to do work in New York and wants to risk capital? The judge arbitrarily decided that this is the right amount. I don't understand it. No developer does. It's an atrocity. It's an embarrassment, but it's an assault on real estate. And then O'Leary pointed out that very few business sectors generate the level of cash flow that real estate does. And of course, historically, one of the very best at that game has been Donald Trump. If you enjoy conservative talk radio, this should have you quaking in your boots. George Soros is poised to take a massive stake in the nation's second largest radio company, which owns more than 220 stations nationwide, according to court filings and sources close to the situation. Fortunately, iHeart is way larger than Odyssey. But in an article written by Josh Cosman and Ariel Zilber in the New York Post, the left-leaning billionaire's Soros Fund Management has bought up $400 million of debt in Odyssey. The company, Odyssey, had to file for bankruptcy. And in New York City, the stations include New York's WFAN and 1010 WINS, as well as Los Angeles-based KROQ, according to bankruptcy filings. Now, between those two coasts, you have a lot of other radio stations that I'm sure are going to be changing format once this takes effect. And I'm assuming that this will be approved. Now, maybe it won't. Still too early to tell. It does have to be approved by certain federal agencies. But one insider close to the situation, noting that he was a Republican, said that he believed it was possible Soros was buying the stake to exert influence on public opinion in the months leading up to the 2024 presidential election. And he said, this is scary. I'll tell you what I find scary is that Soros is still alive. Sheesh. But anyhow, sources told the New York Post that Soros' stake is equal to about 40% of the company's senior debt, which is a massive chunk, although not a majority. And it could yield effective control of the media giant when it emerges from bankruptcy. See, that's the catch right there. Now, Soros scooped up the debt during the past couple of weeks at roughly 50 cents on the dollar from hedge fund H.G. Vora. And Odyssey confirmed the Soros investment after reports of the deal surfaced. And Odyssey said in their statement, "The decision by our existing and new debt holders to become equity holders in Odyssey represents a significant vote of confidence in our company and the future of the radio and audio business." Well, I've been in that business since 1962, and that's bullcorn. Now, Soros Fund naturally didn't respond to a request for comment. A spokesman for H.G. Vora declined to comment as well. And a hearing to approve the Odyssey restructuring plan is slated any day now, apparently, before U.S. Judge Christopher Lopez. And that's going to happen here in Houston, in a Houston bankruptcy court. In fact, it may already have happened. Weren't they going to do that the other day? Haven't read anything on it since. But Odyssey filed for bankruptcy on January 7th with $1.9 billion of debt. Now, under Odyssey's current Chapter 11 bankruptcy plan, existing shareholders are expected to be wiped out. High-ranking creditors like Soros would be repaid with stock in the restructured company. Now, the proposal requires bankruptcy court approval. Again, I want to reemphasize that. So, this is just the latest media play for Soros. Last summer, a fund linked to Soros joined a consortium of former lenders who paid $350 million for bankrupt Vice Media. Well, Vice Media was already left-wing anyhow. And at one time, Vice was valued at $6 billion. But a judge in Manhattan federal bankruptcy court ruled the Soros Fund Management and Fortress Investment Group represented the best option to take the Brooklyn-based company out of Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Yeah, but then they're gonna take the entire media concern into far-left ideology. I just hope that it's not approved. Say some prayers. To the Comedy Corner with Mark Riccadonna.
I've done a lot of dumb things in my life. Probably the dumbest thing I ever did is I went skydiving. Anyone here ever been skydiving? Yeah. Couple of you, yeah. Neither of you would need to know this, but there's a weight limit. Did you know that? Yeah, I did not. I didn't know. I'll be honest with you, I didn't even want to go skydiving, but my friends had pot. I showed up. First thing you do when you skydive is you have to sign paperwork that basically says that if you die, you won't sue. I'm not a smart man, but that doesn't seem like a good deal. I don't get to sign, though, because as soon as I walk in, the lady behind the counter looks at me and goes, "Excuse me, could you get on the scale?" I go, "What?" She goes, "Just get on the scale, standard procedure." Nobody else had to do it. In front of everybody, I walk up, I step on the scale. She comes up with her clipboard, looks, and goes, "Close enough." Close enough? We're jumping out of an airplane. I don't need my chute going. She's like, "Don't worry about it. Go out back." We were in Long Island, which if you ever go there, they don't do things by the book. I went out for my safety instructions. It was a guy with a purple mohawk blasting Bon Jovi at full blast. And I liked the song, so I didn't hear a word he said. Right? I walked out and saw a guy go, "We gotta hold on, ready or not. All right, get on the plane." I was like... I missed everything. I see a line form. I figure that's what we're doing, right? Everybody's in line, so I stand in. As I'm standing there, I see guys come out, right? And these guys have the parachutes. And they drop them on your feet. They look you up and down. They hit you on the shoulder. You get on the plane. I'm the last one. So as I'm standing there, a guy comes out with a parachute, drops it on my feet, hits me on the shoulder, and goes, "You're way too fat to jump out of this plane." I go, "Too fat to jump out, too fat to jump, too fat to jump." Look, I know I'm built more for a lazy river tube ride. But too fat to fall? That goes against everything I know. He goes, I'm the jump master. My rules. I was fine with leaving. I didn't even want to be there in the first place. So I start walking away. My friends are on the plane, and they want me on the plane. So my one friend sticks his head out in front of everybody at the airport and yells, hey, didn't we used to parachute tanks out of planes in World War II? There's about to be a fight. I start walking toward that plane. The lady who let me through sees this all happen. So she comes running out. She's like, sir, I feel so bad. I tell you what, I'll give you and your friends a full refund. And I know another place down the street. They let fat people jump.
That's it. Have a wonderful weekend. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you on Monday's Bombastic Blogcast. Remember, no such thing as spare change, free lunch, or too much horsepower. And be sure to take some time today just to thank the good Lord that you're an American.
You mean that's it?